This is BVK for Ocean City Tourism, OCMD streaming audio. On March 11th, 2024, the title of the spot is STSA Leisure Summer. This is a 30-second composite stereo streaming audio mix.
Get away with friends to the laid-back Maryland coast, where you can catch up while casting off and hang 10 while hanging out, where a day on board is never boring. Full throttle is half the fun. Where you can sink a putt, raise a glass, and there's always room for one more round. Ocean City, Maryland. Somewhere to smile about. Book your trip at OCOcean.com.
Ask Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off Duration and SuperDeck products May 17th through the 20th. That means 30% off our most popular color family, blue. Psychologists have found it to be soothing and relaxing, which makes it especially great for bedrooms and bathrooms. And of course, get 30% off all of our other colors. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Welcome to Pod Save America. I'm John Favreau.
I'm John Levitt.
I'm Tommy Vitor.
On today's show, a mass shooter in Buffalo embraces a version of the racist replacement theory. You hear from Tucker Carlson and some Republican politicians. Joe Biden sharpens his midterm message by coining the phrase, ultra MAGA. Americans join nationwide protests to defend abortion access. And later, New York Times reporter Jonathan Martin joins the pod to talk about his new book, This Will Not Pass. But first, always check out What a Day, Cricket's daily news show, but especially today's episode, which covers the racist massacre in Buffalo and the nationwide protests over Roe v. Wade, including interviews with activists who were there. It's a tough but powerful episode that is definitely worth listening to. Check it out. All right, let's get to the news. On Saturday, a heavily armed 18-year-old wearing tactical gear walked into a Buffalo supermarket and murdered 10 people while live streaming the massacre on Twitch. 11 of the 13 people shot by the killer were black, which is what he wanted. Shortly before the massacre, he posted a 180-page memo that said he began browsing extremist sites like 4chan and 8chan because he was bored during the pandemic, and he ultimately came to embrace replacement theory, which is a racist belief that Western elites, and particularly Jews, are trying to replace white people and dilute their power by allowing immigration. The Buffalo killer, who plagiarized two-thirds of his manifesto from the Christchurch killer who murdered dozens of Muslims in New Zealand back in 2019, wrote that black people are replacers as well. A version of replacement theory has been mainstreamed by Tucker Carlson and Republicans like the third-ranking House Republican Elise Stefanik, Senator Ron Johnson, and J.D. Vance, who argue that Democrats only support immigration to register more Democratic voters. So, sure enough, an Associated Press poll this month found that one in three Americans now believe that an effort is underway to replace native-born Americans with immigrants for electoral gains. Tommy, to what extent are Tucker Carlson and some of these Trumpy Republican politicians at fault for these numbers?
For the numbers, I think they're significantly at fault. I think in the specific case of this horrific shooting in Buffalo, there's no evidence yet that this individual was watching Tucker. It sounds like it was Reddit, 4chan, 8chan, and that, of course, could have included Tucker Carlson content. We don't know. But I think the role that Tucker plays in particular is he is the bridge between the far right, overtly, proudly racist, anti-Semitic fringe, and what you can say on cable TV. He bridges that gap. So Tucker doesn't say, you know, there's a Jewish plot to bring black and brown people into this country and replace white voters. He says Democrats want to replace legacy Americans with more obedient people from faraway countries. That's how he tries to sand it down. And I always think back to how in like July of 2020, we learned that Tucker's head writer was fired because CNN found out that this guy was posting on a like virulently overtly racist online forum and had been doing it for years. And this is a guy who wrote for Tucker's show, helped write his books, helped started working at the Daily Caller, in fact. And so this is kind of like what we've learned is the MO of Tucker's show. They troll extreme right-wing sites. They sanitize things just enough and they spread it to the masses. And the New York Times found that in more than 400 episodes of his show, Carlson amplified the notion that Democratic politicians and other elites want to force demographic change through immigration. So big picture, like the core sentiment and ideas that make up the Great Replacement Theory are not new, draws from very old racist anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that have been around forever. But Tucker is mainlining it into millions of households every night.
Yeah, and I think he serves the role of sparking people's curiosity. So they see something mentioned on his show and then they start looking online and they Google. Go down some much more extremist rabbit holes. And he helps legitimize it by sort of sanding down some of the more extremist edges of the stuff that you find online for cable. Love it. What do you think?
I think whether or not this person was specifically inspired by Tucker Carlson or specifically inspired by Elise Stefanik is sort of beside the point. Like the hold of this kind of rhetoric on the right is a threat to the country, and it's a threat to the country and a menace, whether or not at like the very bottom of this engagement funnel from like casual trolls on social media to like racist 4chan posters to the people shouting lock her up to insurrectionists. There's someone today or tomorrow or the next day at the very bottom of this pit of violent racist rhetoric who will go all the way, right? And they will take it upon themselves to do violence. This will happen regularly. It will happen unpredictably for the indefinite future. You know, at any time, there's some number of broken, angry, lonely, socially maladjusted young men who are losing touch with reality. They are radicalizing in one way or another, and they're becoming more capable of violence, and they will latch onto this fascistic, hateful, racist conspiracy theory because it's ideal, it's perfect, and either it will find them or they will find it. And when someone as prominent as Tucker Carlson gives it purchase, it means it is everywhere. He's the most prominent white nationalist in America, which probably makes him the most prominent white nationalist in the world. So that's what I think.
Yeah, and I think it's not just a danger of radicalizing individuals here. They are organizing because they are finding each other online. This is why the manifesto was, two-thirds of it was plagiarized from the Christchurch killers manifesto, right? Like this is multiplying. I think the person who put it best was not necessarily a Democrat or someone on the left, but Liz Cheney, a conservative Republican, tweeted this morning. The House GOP leadership tweeted Monday morning. The House GOP leadership has enabled white nationalism, white supremacy, and anti-Semitism. History has taught us that what begins with words ends in far worse. GOP leaders must renounce and reject these views and those who hold them. It's a lot more than just being upset at Donald Trump for the insurrection. She's gone a little broader at this point.
Yeah.
In her accusation.
She's speaking truth here.
So Elise Stefanik is being criticized for Facebook ads she ran last fall that accused Democrats of, quote, a permanent election insurrection because their plan to offer a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants will, quote, overthrow our current electorate and create a permanent liberal majority. Her spokesman responded Monday morning by saying she's, quote, never advocated for any racist position or made a racist statement. Sure. Tommy, what do you think of the now common right wing response to all this, that this is just a disagreement about immigration policy?
Yeah. The challenge is this framework for how they want to discuss immigration, or this disagreement over immigration policy is just sort of fundamentally race based. If you're going to say, I'm not racist, I just don't think we should allow any more immigration from the continent of Africa, are we going to pretend that there's not a fundamentally racist approach there? They're saying that there's a majority white group of people in America now who are legitimate, and the new people who want to come in are not legitimate or not as worthy. And again, back to Tucker Carlson, Tucker says the worst attack on our democracy in 160 years was not the insurrection, it was the Immigration Act of 1965. That law got rid of the previous system, which basically overtly tried to preserve America's racial makeup by promoting immigration from Northern and Western Europe. So, you know, they're kind of giving up the game here. It's also just pathetic. You're a political party. Compete for votes. You know, I mean, what is it about new immigrants that you think makes them Democratic? It's again, the race.
It's also, it's wrong.
It is wrong.
in recent years,
especially with Latino voters,
the assumption that new immigrants will vote for Democrats is just wrong and racist on its own. And look, you know, Rich Lowry and some other people on the right were pointing out today, like, oh, well, Democrats used to say that a diversifying nation would help them. There is a bit of a difference between saying certain demographic groups are maybe more likely to vote for one party or the other and accusing one party of a plot to open our borders so that one demographic group can replace another. Like, I don't know how you can't tell the difference between those two things.
I think they can tell the difference, actually, yeah. is what I think. I think they can tell the difference. Yeah, I mean, look, it's like Stefanik's rhetoric is you know, she is delegitimizing immigration. She's delegitimizing their votes. Like, this idea of being replaced, of being overthrown, of it being an insurrection. It is saying your power is being taken illegitimately by these people, these other people. Carlson has called them like legacy Americans, right? Like people who have been here for generations, that they should count more, have more of a say, right? So they all know what they're doing. They all know what they're saying. And, you know, Stefanik is entirely cynical. She is maybe the most cynical, and she sees where her people are going, and that's where she wants to lead them.
She was a formerly mainstream Republican who was once criticized by anti-immigration groups for supporting legal status for undocumented workers. You talk to people who went to school with her at Harvard, they'll tell you she was just a moderate Republican then. Tommy, what do you think happened to Elise Stefanik?
You know, she's not the first or last Republican who became a political coward when it comes to the immigration debate. I mean, remember Marco Rubio was going to lead the fight on the right to get to comprehensive immigration reform. She, in a lot of ways, she makes me more, Elise Stefanik, that is, makes me more frustrated and nervous than like the Paul Gosart, Marjorie Taylor Greene lunatic fringe, because I just think she's doing this for personal gain.
Yeah.
And it tells you a dangerous story about the trajectory of the Republican Party. I mean, she made a bet around impeachment to go full MAGA and rake in that campaign money and motivate her base voters. And then she made a play for leadership, knowing that the far right doesn't really trust her, which is why she got even Trumpier still. And she's calling Democrats pedo grifters. That was over the weekend, I think. And, you know, the one ironclad rule of like MAGA world is you can never cave to the left. You can never tell the social justice warriors online that they're right, right? And so she's just as dug in as she's going to be.
She's a little bit of like New York's J.D. Vance. It's entirely manufactured. It's entirely a performance. It's a shift you watched unfold in real time. But there was something so despicable and revealing about the statements she put out today. 10 people are dead. It is a terrible tragedy. It is a tragedy in her state. And if you look at the statement that she put out, the first few lines are her expressing sadness at the event, and the vast majority of it is victimizing herself, her spokesperson, just performing for Fox News, playing the victim. There is no tragedy that they can't turn into an opportunity to feel as though they're being made a victim, even though 10 people are dead because of hateful rhetoric that she very much spouted.
Yeah, she is like Kevin McCarthy or J.D. Vance or so many Republicans, a power-hungry phony. They know better. They see where the base is. They see where Tucker's leading the party every night, and they want the position. And you know what? She got to be number three in the House when they kicked Liz Cheney out, and now she someday wants the speaker job, right? And so she's going to say whatever it takes to get there.
I just, like, if you do have a sincere disagreement on immigration policy, just acknowledge that talking about replacement is linking you to this rhetoric that has incited multiple mass murderers. The Tree of Life Synagogue, the El Paso shooter, Buffalo, Christchurch, Charleston shooter Dylan Roof, like, posted Nazi references, that Norwegian psycho shot up a summer camp, right? Like, at some point, you have to just acknowledge reality and think to yourself, am I actually contributing to a problem where innocent people are getting massacred regularly? Yeah. That's where my head would be.
Yeah.
And we have these debates over these individual examples, but the thing I always come back to is this idea of like sort of stochastic terrorism or stochastic fascism. You pump enough of this filth into the air over and over and over again, there are enough broken people in this world that somebody is going to follow your argument to its logical conclusion, and that will continue to happen. It will just continue to happen.
So the killer live streamed the massacre on the platform Twitch, which said it removed the video within 2 minutes of the start of the violence. But by that time, it was already shared hundreds of times on other social media platforms. And of course, the killer was radicalized online, as we mentioned. Lovett, what responsibility do social media companies have to keep this violence and extremism off their platforms? And how much can they actually do?
They have a lot of responsibility, and they can do more. You know, they hide behind scale they're doing the best they can, that these things are hard. These are hard problems to solve. but we don't accept a supermarket that said they built the store too big and so some of the food will kill you. We don't accept building codes that say our building is too big. Some of it may fall down on top of you. You built these machines. And if you guys don't want to spend the money and put in the resources and put in the time to figure out how to keep this stuff off of your platform, that is not something we need to accept. That's a problem they have to solve.
Tommy, what do you think?
I mean, they did a good job keeping ISIS propaganda off a lot of these platforms. And I don't understand how that can't extend to incidents like this. Like, sure, you know, from what I read, CNN reported that like 20 people were watching this thing live. And then they conspired together on 4chan to find ways to save and re-upload the video. But I mean, last night I was looking around on Twitter, and if you searched Buffalo shooter, the video would just pop up and autoplay in your feed. And that is terrifying. And it was all over Facebook. I saw some reporting that Facebook said it didn't violate their terms of service.
Right.
And like, this has been happening for years. I don't know how they haven't figured this stuff out. Millions of people end up seeing these videos. This shooter was inspired by an identical video by someone else. I don't get how we cannot stop this.
Content moderation is difficult, but sometimes these platforms would like you to believe it's impossible, and it is not. Like, you know, it's good that Twitch took it down after 2 minutes, but it raises the question, should the ability to live stream be so easily accessible? Twitch allows anyone to go live. YouTube requires users to verify their account and have at least 50 subscribers, so they're even putting up some kind of barriers that Twitch doesn't have. Like you mentioned on Twitter, Twitter hadn't removed a lot of the posts until contacted by the New York Times, and then they put out a statement saying, okay, now we're going to go remove the posts. But clearly they were up there for a long time.
I saw them before I walked in today, still on their site.
Treat it with the seriousness that you would take something really dangerous, like a tit on Instagram.
Right.
Or an unauthorized bit of Warner Brothers footage. You know?
Right. I mean, YouTube can take down a song in an instant. You know what I mean? Like, why can't you take down the sound of a gunshot?
Well, it also shows why Elon Musk's comments about free speech and Twitter, that, you know, he's going to allow as much free, he's not going to go beyond the law and he's going to allow everything else. Well, the manifesto would be allowed under the law. A lot of this stuff, this filth, this hate, that's all over social media, that's radicalizing people, is not technically against the law, but it is certainly hate speech that is within the power of a lot of these platforms to control. And to say that you're going to go buy Twitter and just let everything go that's within the law is a cop-out, ignorant, all of the above.
Yeah. He's not thought about this for more than 2 minutes, as evidenced by his recent tweets.
Yeah.
He's also got a little bit of a buyer's remorse, it seems. He's very much caught the car, and he's like, I don't like the way this car tastes.
He caught the car, and the car's value went down 30%. So he's like, bots?
Trying to find lame excuses to get out of this. One person who's been more aggressive in calling out Republican extremism lately is President Biden. Last week, he coined the phrase, quote, ultra MAGA, during a speech about the economy, and he called Trump the great MAGA king. There's apparently some research behind this. The Washington Post reports that the Center for American Progress and Biden advisor Anita Dunn conducted a six-month project where they found that voters view the word MAGA as more negative than even phrases like Trump Republicans. And in battleground areas, more than twice as many voters said they'd be less likely to vote for someone called a MAGA Republican than would be more likely. Trump and other Republican politicians, of course, are embracing the label and using it to sell merch and raise money. Tommy, do you buy the research? Is this the midterm message about Republicans we've all been waiting for?
Ultra MAGA kind of reminded me of Clockwork Orange, like ultra violence. Yeah. I wonder if that was intentional. I think that calling your opponent extreme is a tried and true method to win elections. Not a big fan of ultra MAGA. I'm not a big fan of the great MAGA king. The latter in particular does sound like a compliment, but if they could tell a larger story about the extremism of the modern Republican Party, from, you know, banning abortion to tax code to whatever, like string it all together, tell a story, make it a narrative. Sure. I don't think we should run around calling Donald Trump king.
He likes it.
Burger King. I don't know.
Trump.
No, none of it.
Trump likes it. Trump's going to be selling MAGA King t-shirts. I think they already are.
I think they are too.
Love it.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I think of ultra, I think of, you know, a kind of watery beer. But I think MAGA Republicans is good. I think ultra MAGA, I don't mind it. It does feel like it's gilding the lily. And isn't the whole point that the MAGA is the extreme piece? Like, MAGA Republicans are bad. We don't need them to be.
Are there MAGA Republicans we're okay with? Like, is it only the ultra MAGAs that we have to worry about?
It was the first day of rolling it out, Joe. We don't need the new model yet. You know, let's try MAGA Republicans for a beat. That's the thing they tested, you know?
Well, MK Ultra.
MK Ultra, right. They tested LSD on people? Is that what that is?
Among other things, yeah.
Cool.
So I will say, I Cap and Anita, like, I trust the research that says that MAGA is useful here and works and is effective. I'm surprised that MAGA works better, MAGA Republican works better than Trump Republicans, just because you'd think more people would be aware of Trump than the phrase MAGA, but, you know, whatever, that's the research. I do think that the key here for Democrats is you can't shortcut the story for why the Republican Party is extremist by just using the word MAGA. This is like Terry McAuliffe calling him Glenn Trumpkin and just like letting it go. Like, you got to tell the whole story. I know that sometimes Democrats are obsessed with like the, you know, we need a bumper sticker message and where's our Frank Luntz and let's listen to George Lakoff and all that bullshit. And you get yourself a slogan, right? It's not the slogan. It's not the phrase that sells it. It's the story behind why they're MAGA Republicans. So we have to just be sure to use clear examples over and over and over again of their extremism to remind people of why they're extreme and not just call them MAGA and think that's going to do all the work. That's just one caution.
And I do think Biden did that when he was rolling out the MAGA. He told the story in a really good way. And I do think that the kind of two pillars, these sort of, they're telling you how to live, here are the ways they're coming after your teachers, your doctors, your healthcare decisions, all of that. And they're also coming after Medicare, they're coming after Medicaid, they're coming after Social Security, the sort of Rick Scott agenda, like those two things together tied to MAGA Republicans, I think is very good.
Explore the world's hidden wonders on the Atlas Obscura podcast, a village in India where everyone's name is a song, a boiling river in the Amazon, a spacecraft cemetery in the middle of the ocean. Every day, the Atlas Obscura podcast will blow your mind in 15 minutes. You can find it on the SiriusXM app, Pandora, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow the show so you never miss an episode.
So before we get to the interview, we thought we'd end on an optimistic note. There were hundreds of marches and rallies on Saturday where tens of thousands of people turned out to protest the Supreme Court's expected decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. Our team at What a Day talked to some people at the Los Angeles protest. You can hear that segment on today's What a Day. And we will also have a special preview at the end of this episode. So stick around for that. Thanks to the What a Day team for grabbing that audio. Tommy, Emily, Charlie, and I were also at the protest. Love it. I know you were at the D.C. protest. What'd you guys think of the crowd and the energy? Love it. What'd you think in D.C.?
Well, to be honest, at first I was just there to get a picture so I could virtue signal on Instagram. That was the goal. That was the whole reason I was there. But then it had a surprising impact on me the more I stayed around.
What impact was that?
Well, you know, there's something, I hadn't been to a protest since in a year or two, and it was just really heartening to be out there, especially, I rented a bird scooter and I was driving around and I was kind of skirt into this protest, kind of hang for a bit and then drive to another part of it. And I kind of went up, Capitol Hill a little bit ahead of the protest and I kind of turned left. And then I saw the whole march coming up Capitol Hill towards the Supreme Court. And it was massive. It was massive. And for one little moment, my cynical heart opened. The sun was shining in my mind. It was very moving. And I felt like I wanted to fight.
Ooh.
And it was just great seeing everybody. It really was. It was good seeing everybody out there.
Tommy, what'd you think?
It's been a long time since there have been protests quite that large. And I think it's good that people turned out to talk about Roe specifically, because it's a critical issue to a lot of people. I think it's good for the Democratic Party to flex that muscle again, because we're going to need more direct action in the coming years. And I also think one of the things that I really love about marches and rallies like that is that you can see people finding joy and community in just coming together and being together. you know, people are angry and they're sad and they're scared about what's happening in the world. But unlike the constant anger and nastiness on the internet, like you see people with funny signs, they're with groups of friends, they're coming together. And that, I think, is the power of these marches. Like, you can fight for something and have fun and do it with people you care about and find real joy and purpose in that movement. And I think that's an important thing to remember or to realize for the first time and to want to be a part of, because we need people to turn out for these marches and not think, oh, that's something other people do.
There is no substitute for in-person physical community organizing. We've all been living through this pandemic for the last several years. A lot of people may do with organizing online, but again, you just referenced this, like, the more you are watching these stories unfold on your phone, the more you are seeing the cynicism and dejection and disappointment only, and you're not seeing sort of like the inspirational nature of people coming together to fight. And when we walked down there this weekend, that's what you saw. You saw people ready to fight. You saw people inspired. You saw people ready to take action. And you don't see that shit if you're just scrolling through Twitter all day or on Facebook or Instagram or wherever else.
It also was really nice to see. It was mostly women, at least the protests that I saw, plenty of men. But it was like, you know, Gen Z all the way to just, you know, baby boomers that have been out there protesting for 50 years. Yep. And it was great seeing that. It was just so many furious women, just like happy to be out with each other and feeling connected to each other. And I felt glad to be able to see that. When we got to the Supreme Court, there was a very small anti-abortion protest, and it was peacefully but fully surrounded by like cheering and dancing younger people. And then there were just all these sort of older couples coming through. It was great to see.
Yeah, I'll say that we met a woman who told us, please relay to Lovett that I'm a baby boomer and I'm here.
Yep.
So you've maybe made an impression on an entire generation.
You've offended.
Which is great.
And as I've said
decades
before,
of people.
I'll say it again to all the baby boomers listening. You're not the ones I'm talking about. You've done your best to overcome the lead poisoning that has ravaged your mind due to leaded gasoline.
Jesus Christ. I think that's different today.
Cut off the feet in New York. Thanks. Thank you.
Love you.
All right. When we come back, Tommy and I will talk to New York Times reporter Jonathan Martin about his new book, This Will Not Pass.
As a chef and a restaurant owner, I'm as meticulous about my cookware as I am about my ingredients. That's why I love Made In Cookware. Each pan they make isn't just designed to perform, it's crafted to last. As a mom, I love that I can trust Made In. It's made from the world's finest materials, so I can feel good about what I'm feeding my family. I'm Chef Brooke Williamson, and I use Made In Cookware. Shop chef quality pots and pans at madeincookware.com.
Joining us now, New York Times national political correspondent and co-author with Alex Burns of the blockbuster New York Times bestseller, This Will Not Pass, Jonathan Martin. Welcome to the pod.
Man, so this is why Favs is a gifted speechwriter, Tommy. He can deliver that kind of prose, man. It's just effortless. You like that?
No. He meant blockbuster, like the video store that went out of business. So it's happening to the book industry, pal. How you doing?
You know, I'm old enough to actually recall some big nights of Blockbuster myself back in the day.
I know, me too. I just dated myself. Jonathan, I've been reading the book. It is excellent. I imagine a lot of our listeners have seen all the scoops that have spilled out of the book in advance of publication. So I want to start with a bit of a process question because, you know, I'm talking to a New York Times political reporter. So when in Rome. You guys took some shit on Twitter for quote unquote holding things for the book. As much as I would love to scream at you for old time's sake, I found a bunch of that criticism a bit off and a bit of a misunderstanding about how book reporting gets done and the way people are willing to talk to reporters like you for a book versus tomorrow's paper. Can you explain to listeners how that works and how you decide like what goes in the paper versus a book?
Yeah. Well, first of all, guys, thanks for having me on. And full disclosure, I've known these two cats for many years. back before they were on the fashionable left coast, they were trudging away in D.C. So, guys,
you were just a blogger, I think. Were you a blogger at some startup?
Politico?
That's right. ThePolitico.com. So it's a good question. And I think it's fair to get that critique. I would say two things. Like one, well, first of all, I would just say generally as a rule, we don't discuss sourcing, but like two things generally on this topic. One is, when you're speaking to people and the ground rules are for a book, obviously, the response is different. The nature of the conversation is different. And especially when it comes to sensitive matters, it's a very different conversation and sort of dialogue. And people are much more willing to talk candidly when they know that they're speaking for history and not for, you know, tomorrow's paper or even next week's paper. And I think in the case of this book, we were really pleased with people in both parties, like how much they opened up talking about this period after we assured them, you know, of course, that this is not going to be out for a year or so. And so that was striking. The other thing is you have to have like pretty ironclad agreements that like this is for the paper, this is for the book, because otherwise it's obviously going to create challenges. So I think those two things are important. And just like the last thing I'll say is, the nature of this business, as you guys know, stuff doesn't come wrapped with a big red bow outside your door. That's like the Hollywood version of journalism, where it's like, oh my gosh, we have this amazing scoop in our lap that we never even asked for. Let's start writing. It's like, no, it's a grind. It is like weeks and months of working, like various tips and hearsay and second and third hand material, and then trying to track it down. Is that right? Is it wrong? Is it kind of right? And like, that's just the sort of nature of this business. And so it is not a glamorous, like Hollywood ending where it's like, oh, we have this thing dropped from above in our lap and we can just sort of print it. It's a much more, lengthy, grueling process.
Mm-hmm. I like that these people bought themselves a year. Like they oh, they're not going to screw me in tomorrow's paper next week, but a year from now, maybe I'll have a different job and it won't be a concern.
Yeah, in fairness to them, I think it was more just like, you know, this is an important moment in American history. Can you talk honestly about like what happened at XYZ conversation or moment? And I think just like the nature of politicians is that if they have some assurance that it's not going to be immediate, or that they're obviously going to like, you know, have their say for history, it makes it easier for them to talk. And that's the other thing too, is like, I think this period is so consequential for a lot of political actors that when you talk to them, they kind of want to have their say and they want to have their voice and sort of capture, in their eyes, what happened and why it happened.
It's a future me problem. It's like when you agree to go out to dinner with someone who sucks.
Exactly right. I mean, the impression I get from your book and the last few years of following politics is that Republican leaders love how Trump excites their base, but hate how he repels swing voters. And that's why they can't really figure out how to deal with them. Like, do you think that's a fair reading of the dynamic?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think it's even more straightforward than that, Favs. I mean, I think it's just their primary voters like Trump, and nothing he does or says makes them stop liking him. And so they feel like they're handcuffed to Trump because their voters like him. Especially in the House, I just don't feel like it's more complicated than that. If tomorrow Donald Trump stopped being popular with rank and file Republican voters, I have no doubt that the bulk of House Republicans would happily move on, right? It's just an entirely a demand side issue. As long as like the voters and their primaries like the former president, like that's going to compel the leaders of the party in the House to stick with them, you know?
You had some really interesting reporting on Joe Biden's vice presidential selection process.
Yeah.
A couple of distinct pieces. One, you guys wrote about how close Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois came to becoming the vice president But yeah. You report that Biden's team was worried that because she was born in Thailand to a Thai mom and American dad, she could have faced essentially a birther conspiracy right. or a legal challenge.
Yep.
Do you think Duckworth is VP if not for that fear?
I'm not sure I'd go that far. I think the murder of George Floyd and subsequent protest, I think were probably enough that Biden felt like he ought to pick an African-American vice president. And I certainly think Senator Duckworth was a contender. I'm just not sure it got to the final stage. But it does speak to like the shadow that Trump cast, right? That even the perception that he would make this an issue and find like some circuit court judge somewhere to potentially knock Biden off the ballot in a given state was like enough that they just, you know, weren't totally sure it was worth pursuing. But no, like this is a fascinating point that you raise. Look, obviously, we get why a lot of the reporting in here that's been picked up is on the Republican side, but half the book is on Democrats and on Biden in particular. And there's tons in there about both Biden and the 2020 campaign, Biden putting together his cabinet, and then Biden trying to govern in 2021.
Yeah. Well, so the other part of the vice presidential selection process that really jumped out at me is you guys report that Reid Hoffman, who's a tech billionaire donor, did a bunch of polling and focus groups about the vice presidential nominees, and that got pushed into the official vetting process. Did that surprise you, that kind of like a donor-led, I don't know, research project became part of Joe Biden's selection process?
Not totally, because I think Biden was willing to sort of take that into account. I'm not super surprised that you know, they would look at that given the detail of the polling, which, by the way, we obtained. That doesn't surprise me too much. I mean, I think what's striking is just how sort of raw the numbers were in terms of like the American voters were going to be pretty uneasy about whichever African-American woman was picked. And I think that was pretty sobering for the Biden folks. And I think, you know, they believe that we have to pick somebody with sort of maximum credentials because the electorate's going to be skeptical with this. And so I think Vice President Harris had been a state AG, had been a senator, had been a prosecutor at the local level from the country's largest state, was probably like the best sort of credentials among the black women that they were considering.
You mentioned a lot of the book is about sort of Joe Biden's.
And by the way, Barack Obama, a fellow you guys know well, was pretty candid with the Biden folks about this, which is not discouraging them from picking a black woman, but just being real about the challenges out there with the electorate. You know, this is going to be a real challenge. I think the Biden folks knew that, you know. Sorry, go ahead, John.
He lived through it.
Absolutely.
You mentioned a lot of the book is about Biden's challenges governing the first couple of years. Here's something I've always gone back and forth on. Like, I have heard from sources close to the White House that they came to believe late in the game that Joe Manchin was never really serious about wanting to do a deal on Build Back Better, that he was always just trying to find an excuse to say no to kill the thing.
Yes.
Do you think he was ever serious about a deal? Do you think he'd do a smaller deal now?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I've definitely picked that same kind of ex post facto regret from the White House, too, that, you know, he was forever looking for the next excuse. It could have been the war in Ukraine one day, and the next day it could have been inflation. It was always something to sort of not take the bite out of the apple. Look, I think if you look at what he put on paper and gave to Senator Schumer over the summer of 2021, outlining like what he could do, if they had called his bluff on that and like kind of written that bill and then put it in front of him and jammed it through the House, I think they had a shot. I just think like every day that went on into the fall, it got harder and harder with him. And then once inflation became real, that was just obviously his sort of the excuse he was going to ride, you know?
Have you heard this rumor that he might want to run for president in 2024.
I have. I've heard three things. Four. He's going to run for president in 24. He's going to run for governor in 24. Not run at all and retire and then run for re-election. I've heard all four of those. Wow. I mean, okay. I remember doing a story right before the filing deadline in 2018 because Schumer was really nervous that Manchin was not going to file. And this rumor like spread through the Senate and the caucus was petrified he was not going to file because obviously he's the only Democrat that can hold that seat out there. And they got him to run again, but he famously said, "This place sucks," talking about Washington. And that was like on the record in my story. And so he does this and sort of grumbles about coming back to the Senate. I want to be governor again. And I think, guys, that this is sort of part of what he does. He enjoys being in Washington. He likes being in the mix. He likes going on TV. And he grumbles about it, but I think he really enjoys it. And if I had to guess, knowing him, I think he's going to run for re-election in 24.
Yeah. Politicians tend to like to be in politics. That's what I'm, I bet too. So Jonathan,
and
you guys
have those that have boats where they have like members over for parties and stuff. Like he kind of likes it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. He loves the houseboat.
Totally.
So you guys had this reporting that broke, you know, early, when the book came out.
Yeah.
That Kevin McCarthy had some pretty harsh criticism for Donald Trump. McCarthy and his team denied it.
Can you believe that? I mean, it's so shocking that, you know, who would have thought that Republicans secretly weren't fond of Donald Trump, right?
Yeah. Who would have thought it? Okay, so then you guys, McCarthy's team denies it. Then you release the tapes proving that, in fact, he did say this.
Right.
How do you, as a journalist, deal with someone like McCarthy after that, knowing he lied to your face, lied to the country? I mean, this guy could be Speaker of the House, and he's just
a great question. I mean, yeah, look, I mean, he lied. He did grave damage to his credibility by lying. In the short term, that, you know, his conference professed not to be that bothered by it. But I think you guys have been around politics long enough to know that when you get caught in a lie just that nakedly, it does long-term damage to you. Mm-hmm. And look, it's pretty revealing that the people in the House GOP conference kind of shrugged, like, yeah, of course in private he was torturing Trump. It's kind of like, yeah, you know, we all do, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't really a breaking news headline for them because that's sort of their existence. But the fact he would so brazenly lie like that, look, I think it does create challenges for him down the road. Obviously, in public now, you know, his word's going to be questioned. And with Trump himself, it just makes him that much more beholden to the former president. And I think the reason that Trump didn't torch him is because Trump loves the idea of Kevin being that much more beholden to him and having you know, him that much closer. And so in January, if they do get the House, and Trump's got even more juice in terms of dictating both the speakership election, and then if Kevin is speaker, what happens in the House, you know?
What do you think the chances are that Trump loses the nomination if he runs?
Loses the nomination if he runs. I think today he would be a formidable candidate for president, guys, for the same reason he was in 2016, because he would have a divided field. I mean, he never got 50%, I don't think, in any of the early primaries or caucuses in 16. He was, you know, clocking pluralities in those races. And I think he's going to have the same advantage in 24 if he runs. The field will be smaller because you'll have a bunch of folks peel off who will not run if he runs. But he'll still have a divided opposition. And so he doesn't have to get 51. He just, you know, he cruises along with his solid, you know, third or more of the electorate, and that's enough to win a five-way caucus or primary, right?
Yeah, he did lose to Ted Cruz in that old Iowa caucus too. It's embarrassing.
He lost to Cruz in Iowa, and then after that, he mostly won. He lost Wisconsin, but he mostly won. But he was winning with, you know, 34, 36 kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And I just don't see a scenario where the non-Trump candidates rally around one Trump alternative, right? Because you'll have like the hardcore anti-Trumper, and you'll have the more kind of semi anti-Trumper, right? So,
Yeah. I mean, what comes through in the book, you know, people did speak very freely to you guys, and it's worth reading just for the kind of ex post facto. Like, for example, there was this infamous quote from November 9th, 2020 in the Washington Post, where someone said, "What's the downside for humoring him a little bit, this little bit of time about the results of the election?" Oh, yeah. I'm 100% certain after reading your book that it was Lindsey Graham. I know you can't confirm that because it's a different newspaper, but call Bezos and get him to confirm it. But the other thing that's in there, it's like, you know, McConnell's been all over the place with Trump. Clearly he hates his guts, but, you know, he's recently said he would vote for him. But you report that Mitch McConnell, during the transition period, was calling Trump national security officials and asking them to remain in their jobs to fend off a constitutional crisis, but then he didn't vote to impeach. Is it possible to get into the mind of Mitch McConnell and how you can hold those two thoughts at once? I won't impeach this guy, but I'm calling Gina Haspel, the CIA director, saying, please God, don't leave in case this man tries to stage a coup. I can't understand that.
So, Tommy, I'm amazed that nobody else has picked this up from the book, but we have this scene right after the election where McConnell summons the head of the CIA, Gina Haspel, to come to his suite in the Capitol, McConnell's office in the Capitol, entirely so that the photographers who were there in the Capitol could take the picture of her coming in there, because McConnell wanted to offer her a kind of symbolic vote of confidence to keep her in office during those crazy days after the election. That's a small sort of anecdote in the book, but I think it's really revealing as to how concerned kind of old guard Republicans were about Trump's mindset after the election, and just how serious they were taking this effort that he was obviously leading to overturn the election. Now, let's be honest. It wasn't so much so that they were going to confront Trump about it in public, because they were more worried about keeping those two seats in Georgia in January than about Trump doing anything to overturn the election. And I think the reason for that is precisely the quote that you just cited. And I have to confess, I don't know who said that. But there's always this challenge, right, with Trump is like, and by the way, it's not just with Republicans, some Democrats too. Like, how seriously do we take this guy? Because, some of the stuff he's doing is like kind of scary and like would be authoritarian. But at the same time, they see him, they deal with him, and he's kind of this like seemingly buffoonish, kind of hapless figure. And how scary could he be? This was the conundrum that we sort of capture in this book for, you know, time and time again. And after the election, they're still not taking it seriously enough. Oh, it's my pillow guy at the White House. He's a joker. Right. You know, come on. What kind of a coup can this actually be? And guys, I don't think it's until the Capitol itself's overrun on January 6th that a lot of people in the Republican Party finally sobered up to the threat that Trump presented.
So, I mean, this is a theme throughout the book, the theme of like fear. And, you know, at one point, you guys say that, you know, there's lawmakers in both parties who basically are afraid that there's more political violence to come, and they don't say it publicly. They say it to you guys. They say it to each other, but they're reluctant to talk about it in public. So here's like a personal question. Like, I know you guys are supposed to be objective. You're not supposed to have real feelings about things, right? You're New York Times reporters. Like, but, you know, you're also members of the press. The press has been sort of under assault the last couple of years, as are many of our institutions. Like, how afraid are you personally about the state of democracy?
And not just by Dan Pfeiffer, by the way. I had to get an attack on Pfeiffer at some point during the program.
That's great.
Of course.
We love Dan.
Test to see if he listens to the episode.
I'm really concerned. I think like we came away from this book sobered about the sort of short to medium term prognosis for American democracy. There's not a lot of good news to find. And I think, you know, talking about this book the last few weeks, we get this question a lot from people. Just like, give us some good news. Like, what's the upside here? Well, I just don't see a scenario where the fever breaks. And there's a reason why we call the book This Will Not Pass. And I'm not just doing a shameless plug for the book title. Honestly, I'm not. Like, this is an ongoing challenge. And we had to end the book somewhere, obviously. And so we basically did a sort of two-year account of 20 and 21. So we kind of end it at the start of 22. But it's not easy to know where to end because this is ongoing. I mean, you sort of see what happened in Buffalo over the weekend. We're living in this extraordinarily toxic moment in American politics, and I just don't see a scenario where things are going to turn around. Guys, think about COVID for a minute. I mean, not even for weeks did that bring the country together. A once-in-a-century pandemic, you would think would have some rallying effect on the American people. Everybody's in it together. We're all feeling the pain here. But, you know, that just drove people further to their corners. It deepened the silos in this country. So I just don't have a lot of sort of happy news to offer about the challenges. And I do have a lot of concerns about the assault on institutions, including the press. You know, I look at Pennsylvania over the weekend before the primary, major candidates, like not including the press at their events, it just for arbitrary reasons. Yeah. So it's really disturbing. And I just say one more thing, spending a lot of time in the Capitol, because our bureau in D.C. has basically been closed down for much of COVID. And because the book as well, I spent a lot of time in the Capitol. You guys have been there over the years, too. I cannot begin to capture, and people who work there and listen to this podcast will appreciate this, the sort of the menace in the air, the feeling that January 6th wasn't the end, that it was not a culmination, but that it was only kind of one more grim milestone on the way to more political violence. And every time there's one of these foiled attacks or, you know, kind of uncertain vehicle near the Capitol, people just get really nervous again. And what's even more depressing, guys, is that within the body itself, in the House, especially more than the Senate, there's such mistrust now between the two parties. And not like, oh, they're going to hurt me on this bill, they're going to double cross me in committee, but more like, we could have a fist fight on the House floor like tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's wild.
You guys really do. I mean, I think your personal anxiety about the future of democracy comes through in the introduction of the foreword, but also that sense of menace comes through when you talk about Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, former CIA officer, moderate from Virginia, called AOC on January 6th to say, hey, wear sneakers so you're mobile. Wear sneakers so you're mobile. Don't dress like you. Be low key because I'm worried you're going to be a target. I mean, that is one frightening, two pretty amazing prescience. And it makes you wonder about all the Capitol policing issues, given that, you know, a member of Congress was thinking like that.
Yeah. And these two Democratic members of the famed class of 2018 who could not be more different ideologically, you know, as far on the spectrum as you can be and still be in the same caucus. But Spanberger, having been in the agency, knows that AOC is the most high-profile member of the House Democratic class of 2018, knows that people are going to be targeting her potentially, and so does give her that heads up based upon her own national security background. It's a really fascinating moment. And then, you know, also we have that the leadership of the House Democrats were telling members, you know, don't walk outside, take the tunnels under the Capitol buildings, don't wear your member pins. It was fascinating. And then Anna Eshoo told us, the lawmaker from California, said that, you know, going to the Capitol on January 6th that morning, it was sort of eerie. And she felt like it was that scene from The Godfather where he's rolling up to the toll booth. And so it was just the sort of, you could sort of feel it in the air. There were two lawmakers, Jason Crow from Colorado, Andy Kim from New Jersey. Kim served in the State Department in Afghanistan, and Jason Crow is a former Army Ranger. Both of them sent their wives home before January 6th and said, don't stay for the swearing in. It's not worth it. Something could go down here. So all these members are sensing something in the air in the days before the 6th. And I'll just tell you guys my experience. I was in Georgia on the 5th covering what was supposed to be the big story, those two Senate runoffs. But I knew the 6th was going to be a moment to witness. I caught the last flight from Atlanta back to D.C. on the night of the 5th. And I'm on the plane, and I think it was Delta. they're bringing on not just like flight attendants, but like Delta security staff before the flight even takes off and walking down the aisle and telling folks, put your mask on, settle down, because the entire plane was full of people going to the rally on the 6th. And so I'm thinking to myself, yeah, I don't usually see this kind of security before a plane takes off. And this is a pretty rowdy crowd. So you could sort of feel in the hours ahead of the 6th that something was gonna happen.
Just last thing, because I just can't resist a chance to make fun of Jared Kushner. You report on page 91, for those who are
on
looking
a lighter
for
note.
It, that Jared Kushner personally worked to recruit a campaign manager for Kanye West because Jared thought it would help siphon black voters away from Biden. West ultimately won 71,000 votes. How much time do you think Jared spent on this dumb fucking scheme while he was playing shadow secretary of state and setting up his future $2 billion investment fund that is seeded entirely with Saudi dollars?
And bucks. Also working on the government payroll, I should add.
Yeah.
I know for a fact he spent a lot of time on it. Look, I think he, like his father-in-law, is a great believer in the power of celebrity and came to the conclusion that a prominent African-American celebrity could somehow be like the secret sauce that like they needed to get just enough votes sort of siphoned away from Biden to give them a chance in a lot of swing states, which, frankly tells you a lot about how they view black voters. Also like is just like the most crude political analysis given both Kanye's like lack of knowledge of events and obviously like engagement at all in public life. But it does sort of bring you to the White House and sort of like what these guys were like, especially going into 2020. We talk about this at great length in the book. Everything was calculated upon how it could shape the election and whether it was good for Trump. And look, let's not be naive. Like most presidents are political. They make decisions in part based upon politics. Even the one you guys worked for occasionally did that. But it's almost cartoonish. Trump's talking to these governors who were just desperate for help during COVID. And these governors are trying to get PPE. And they're like having to call Trump himself. And he says literally to Ned Lamont, the governor of Connecticut, ask me nicely.
Yeah. What does he point out in the book? It's not like George W. Bush was like, I'm sorry, we're not going to help New York after 9/11. They're not going to vote for me.
That's right. I mean, and this is what makes Trump different is that every president, at least rhetorically, has tried to unify the country and tried to be a president for all Americans. And like Trump never even fainted toward that. There was never any mystery about who he was representing because he said it out loud. And by the way, that's one of the challenges, guys, about doing a book that involves Trump is that he says everything out loud. So it's not like there's tons of secrets right. about Trump. But that's one of the reasons why I think we wanted to do the book the way that we did, is like a more comprehensive account of this period of political crisis in America. Yes, Trump, but also Biden. Yes, the White House, but also Congress. Yes, Washington, but also governors, mayors. Because like the last 2 years has been this extraordinarily tumultuous time, and not just in the West Wing, right? It was felt in the House, the Senate, with governors, with mayors all over the country. And so we want to sort of capture that in the most rich, comprehensive way possible. So that's what we tried to do.
Well, it's an incredibly well-reported book, terrifying at times, but a good, a very, very good first draft of history. Jonathan Martin,
thank you
so much for joining Pod Save America. The book is This Will Not Pass by Jonathan Martin and Alex Burns. It's now a bestseller.
Read it, hate read it.
Whatever.
Trigger yourself.
Don't
buy one for your friends.
Exactly. Perfect.
Great book.
John, Tommy, thanks, guys.
Thanks,
Aaron.
Thank you.
See ya.
All right, that's our show for today. Thanks again to Jonathan Martin for joining us. We'll talk to you later this week. And now, here's a clip from today's What a Day. You'll be hearing from some activists and protesters who were at the rally in Los Angeles this Saturday.
I am here marching for my granddaughters. Sorry if I get emotional. Oh my God, I just feel like we're going back in time and this would be devastating for my granddaughters.
My mom and my grandparents like fought for this and I just think that if they're gonna try to take that right away from me, that I should try to.
You know, I have a six-year-old daughter here who may someday herself want an abortion, and I want her to have that right.
More genders than just women need abortions, including gender expansive and trans men. So we want to show up for all people who need abortion.
I'm a family physician, and it really concerns me about the safety and health of my patients that if Roe v. Wade is overturned, that it will result in unnecessary deaths and harm.
I'm here today as a postpartum depression survivor who wants better opportunities and better access for my Black daughter to care, whatever that care looks like for them.
I don't love abortion. I don't think that's a great thing. But the idea that the government should be in the doctor's office with me and my doctor deciding what's going on is not okay.
I'm here today because a long time ago, a friend of mine nearly died from a botched abortion. I rushed there and had to rush her immediately to the hospital where if not, she would have died. So I'm here to make sure that that doesn't happen to anybody else.
I think this is a much bigger issue even than just Roe.
The potential of not being able to marry the wife of my dreams, potentially not having access to birth control if I'm raped.
And what it could happen to other groups that have gained some rights in the past 50 years. And if this is a precedent, this is horrible.
I have been marching for women's rights to healthcare and abortion since the 80s. And I'm really tired of this, which is why my sign says enough is enough.
The more people show up, the more that our voice is heard. Hopefully the voice will get louder. And so bullshit like this doesn't keep happening.
As my sign says, I'd rather be doing all these things. I'd rather be going to farmer's market, masturbating, taking a nap, but we're here. We won't stop.
Pod Save America is a Crooked Media production. The executive producer is Michael Martinez. Our senior producer is Andy Gardner-Bernstein. Our producer is Haley Muse, and Olivia Martinez is our associate producer. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis sound engineer the show. Thanks to Tanya Sominator, Sandy Gerard, Hallie Kiefer, Ari Schwartz, Andy Taft, and Justine Howe for production support. And to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Phoebe Bradford, Milo Kim, and Amelia Montooth. Our episodes are uploaded as videos at youtube.com/crookedmedia.
I'm Roman Mars, host of 99% Invisible. I love the book, The Power Broker, the epic biography of former New York City planner Robert Moses. So I'm breaking it down 100 pages at a time and talking to special guests about why this book matters, like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
I actually think if it wasn't for Robert Moses, I probably wouldn't have run for Congress.
Listen to 99% Invisible's breakdown of The Power Broker every month on the 99% Invisible podcast feed.